He looked helplessly at his son and then went on, "Oh sure, you can still live with us, boy. You won't have to pay us board, you can work a bit when you come back from school and eke things out that way. But we just don't have the money to pay for a lot of expensive things. We're living hand to mouth now, barely making a do of it, so think it over, boy, think it over. I think and your mother thinks it'd be a wonderful thing if you could be a doctor, but it would be an awful thing to be a poor doctor because you haven't got enough money to keep going." Mary Bond said, "Alan, you know what happens to failed doctors, don't you? You know what happens to doctors who are struck off, don't you?" Alan looked at her sourly and said, "I only know what rumors I have been told to try to discourage me. I have been told that if a medical student fails or if a doctor is crossed off, he just becomes a hack traveler for some scruffy pharmaceutical firm. Well, what of it?" he queried. "I haven't failed yet, I haven't even started, and if I do fail I still have to earn a living, and if I can earn a living as a medical salesman then it will be a darn sight better living than slinging potatoes in a bag and weighing them up, or counting pineapples, or muck like that." "Stop it, Alan, stop it," said his mother. "You are making fun of your father's trade, and it's your father who is keeping you now. Remember, you show no respect at all, you are getting way above yourself. Why not come down to earth?" Then she said after a long pregnant silence, "Alan, Alan, why not take that job Uncle Bert offered you in the insurance office? It's a real steady job, and if you work hard at it you might even be able to work your way up to be a claims adjuster. Think about it, Alan, will you?" The boy morosely left the room. His parents silently looked at each other and then there was the sound of his footsteps going down the wooden stairs beside the shop. There came the slamming of the street door and the sound of his feet on the sidewalk outside. "Dunno what got hold of that boy," said Martin Bond. "I don't know how we came to produce such a fellow. Ever since he could talk he's been on and on endlessly, monotonously about becoming a doctor. Why the hell can't he settle down like other boys and do some decent job? That's what I want to know, why the hell can't he do it, eh?" His wife silently went on with her task of darning the already much darned socks, and there were tears in her eyes as at last she looked up and said, "Oh, I don't know, Martin, I sometimes think we're too hard on him. It's right, after all, to have an ambition, and there's nothing so dreadful about being a doctor, is there?" Martin snorted and replied heatedly, "Well, I dunno about that. The good earth and the produce thereof is good enough for me. Never did old with these boys mucking about with a woman's innards. Don't seem right to me. I'm going down to the shop." With that he angrily jumped to his feet and stamped down the back stairs. Mary Bond threw down her darning and sat still gazing out of the window. Then at last she got up and went into the bedroom and got down on her knees by the side of the bed, praying for guidance and for strength. After many minutes she rose to her feet again, sniffing and saying to herself, "Funny thing, all the parsons say about praying when one is in trouble, and I do just that, but I've never in my life had a prayer answered. Guess it's all superstition, that's what I think." Sniffling she left her bedroom, and then wiping her eyes upon her apron she started preparing the supper. Alan walked gloomily along the sidewalk. Idly he kicked a can which was in his way. By chance, or was it chance? He kicked a bit hard and the can flew up at an angle and made a tinny clank as it hit a metal plate. Alan looked guiltily around and prepared to run for it, and then he looked at the metal plate. "R. Thompson, M.D.," he read. He went to the metal plate, the brass plate with the incised black wax-filled letters, and rubbed it caressingly with his hands. For some time he just stood there, bowed in thought over the plate let into the wall. "What's the matter, old man?" asked a kindly voice, and a warm hand fell lightly to his shoulder. Alan jumped off the ground in fright and spun around to look up to the smiling face of a big doctor. "Oh, I'm so sorry, Dr. Thompson, I wasn't meaning to do anything wrong," said the boy in some confusion. The doctor laughed at him and said, "Well, well, what a face of misery. Have you taken on all the cares of the world, or what?" "Just about, I guess," replied Alan in a tone of deep despondency. The doctor glanced quickly at his watch and then put an arm around the boy's shoulder. "Come on, lad, come inside, let's talk about it. What have you done? Got a girl in trouble, or something? Is her father after you? Come inside, let's see what we can do about it." The doctor gently led the hesitant boy through the gate, up the little path and into the surgery. "Mrs. Simmons," he called going to the door, "how about rustling up some char for us, and have you got any of those sweet biscuits, or has that lazy husband of yours scoffed the lot?" From somewhere in the depths of the house a muffled voice answered. The doctor went back into his surgery and said, "Okay, boy, get yourself composed, we'll have a cup of tea together and then we'll see what there is to be done." Mrs. Simmons soon appeared with a tray on which were two cups, a jug of milk, a basin of sugar and the very best silver teapot plus, of course, the inevitable silver jug of hot water. She had thought long on the question of should she produce the best silver teapot or an ordinary china one. But then she thought, well, the doctor obviously had someone of great importance there or he would not have called down like that. It wasn't surgery time or anything, not yet. She didn't even know what the doctor was doing at home at such a time. So, the best china and the best teapot, and the best smile on her face as she entered the room. But then her jaw dropped. She thought there would be a lord at least there, or perhaps a lady, or perhaps one of the big business men at the Pool of London, but what she saw was a remarkably despondent-looking, underfed schoolboy. Well, she thought, he was a schoolboy in spite of the fact that he was getting on to be an old schoolboy, but she thought firmly it wasn't her business, so carefully she put down the tray in front of the doctor, bowed a little in her confusion, and went out shutting the door behind her. The doctor poured out some tea saying, "How do you like it, lad, milk first? Or do you like it like me, anything so long as it's wet and warm and fairly sweet?" Alan nodded dumbly. He did not know what to do, he did not know what to say. He was so engulfed in misery, so overcome with the thought that had he failed again? Then he caught himself, again? Now what did he mean by that? He did not know. There was something pressing at the back of his mind, something he ought to know, or was it something he ought not to know? Bemused, he rubbed his head between his hands. "What is it, lad? You are in a state, aren't you? Now just drink this tea and nibble a few of these sweet biscuits and tell me what it's all about. There's plenty of time, I'm supposed to be having a half day off. So let's make it a project to see what's wrong with you and what we can do for you." Poor Alan was not much accustomed to kindness nor to consideration. He had always been considered as the odd one in the family, the odd one in the district, referred to as that young son of a greengrocer who's got such grand ideas. Now the words of the kindly doctor got through to him and he burst into bitter tears. Sobs racked his frame. The doctor looked at him with great concern, and said, "All right, boy, all right, have out your tears, there's nothing wrong in that. Get it out of your system, go on, weep all you want to, there's nothing wrong with it. Do you know, even old Winnie Churchill sheds tears, and if he can you can, eh?" Shamefacedly Alan mopped his face with his handkerchief. The doctor was impressed to notice how clean the handkerchief was and, as the boy held the handkerchief to his eyes, Dr. Thompson also noticed that his hands were clean, his nails were trimmed and there was no dirt in the nails either. The boy went up several points in the doctor's estimation. "Here, lad, drink this," said the doctor as he put a cup of tea in front of Alan. "Stir it up well, there's a great dollop of sugar in it. The sugar will give you energy, you know. Come on, get with it." Alan drank the tea and nervously nibbled a sweet biscuit. Then the doctor filled up the cups again and moved beside the boy saying, "If you feel like it, lad, get the load off your mind, it must be something dreadful, and a load shared is a load halved, you know." Alan sniffed and wiped away errant tears again, and then everything tumbled out of him. How since the very first thing he had known he had the strongest of strong impressions that he had come to be a doctor, how almost the first words he had been able to string together in a sentence had been, "I be doctor." He told Dr. Thompson how all the time he had put aside boyish things, he had studied and studied. How instead of reading adventure stories and science fiction and all that, he had got technical books from the library, to the consternation of the woman librarian who thought it was most unhealthy for a young boy to want to know so much of anatomy. "But I couldn't help it, doctor, really I couldn't," said Alan in dismay. "It was something beyond me, something driving me on. I don't know what it is. I know that all the time I get the urge, an impossible urge, that I've got to be a doctor, no matter what, and tonight my parents have been at me, telling me I've got above myself, that I'm no good." He lapsed into silence again. The doctor put a hand on the boy's shoulder, and softly said, "And what started the outburst tonight, lad?" Alan squirmed in his seat and said, "Doctor, you'll never believe it, but I'm top boy of the class, top boy of the grammar school. This has been the end of term and the headmaster, Mr. Hale, has told me that I have been recommended for a special scholarship at St. Margaret's Pre-Med School, and my parents, well," then he nearly broke down again and twisted his handkerchief into knots between his fingers. "Eh, lad, it was ever thus," said the doctor. "Parents always think that they can control the destiny of those whom they produce, sometimes as the result of an accident too. But never mind, lad, let's see what we can find out. You said you were at grammar school? You said the headmaster, Mr. Hale, well, I know Mr. Hale very well indeed, he's one of my patients. Okay, let's see what he can tell us." The doctor looked up his index and soon found the name of the headmaster and the telephone number, and then quickly he made a phone call. "Good evening, Hale," said Drive Thompson, "Thompson here. I've got a young lad in front of me. He seems a very bright young lad, and he tells me that you have recommended him for a special scholarship." "Good heavens," said the doctor in some amazement, "Hale, I've forgotten to ask the boy's name." At the other end of the line, the headmaster chuckled and said, "Oh yes, I know him, Alan Bond, a very bright lad indeed, exceptionally bright. He's worked like a slave throughout his 4 years here, and I thought he was going to be a failure when he joined in the first case, but I was never more wrong. Yes, it's quite true. He is the top boy in the school, the highest marks we have ever had, and the most progress this school has seen. But," and the headmaster's voice faded for a moment, and then he continued, "I am sorry for the boy. His parents, you know, they are the trouble. They've got that little green grocer's shop down the street, they are making hard going of it, they are strapped for money, and I can't see how that boy is going to manage. I wish I could do something to help him. I've helped him to get a scholarship, but he needs more than that." "Well, thanks a lot, Hale, I appreciate your remarks," said Dr. Thompson, putting down the phone and turning to Alan. "Boy," he said, "I had much the same sort of trouble as you have had. I had to fight every bloomin' inch of the way, scratch with tooth and nail to make a do of it. Okay, tell you what we'll do, let's go along now and see your parents. I told you it's my half day off, and what better way to spend what's left of it than helping some other poor devil who also is having a bad time. Come on, lad, stir your stumps." The doctor rose to his feet and Alan got up as well. At the door, Dr. Thompson gave two rings and then said, "Oh, Mrs. Simmons, I shall be out for a time, just take any messages, will you?" Down the road they strode, the big tall doctor and the undernourished boy who was making a late approach to manhood. Down the street they went, and as they approached the shop they saw the light was on. Through the window they could see Father Bond weighing out bags of produce. The doctor strode to the door, rapped sharply, and put his hands beside his face so he could peer in free of reflections. Martin Bond looked up sourly and then shook his head in negation. He mouthed the word "closed," but then he saw his son there and he thought to himself, "Oh my God, what's the boy done now? What trouble has he brought us now?" And then he hurried to the door and drew back the bolt. The doctor and Alan moved inside, and Martin Bond hastened to slide the bolt shut again. "Good evening. So you're Martin Bond, eh?" said Drive Thompson. "Well, I'm Dr. Thompson and I live down the street, you know, I've got my practice there. I've been talking to your boy and he's a bright young lad, too. I think he deserves a chance. All right for you to talk, Doctor, said Martin Bond truculently. You don't have to scrabble for money in a place one like this. You're set up pretty good, I reckon. You get enough from your fees and from the friendly societies to keep you living high off the hog. I've got to dig in the ground. But anyway, what's the boy done now? He asked. The doctor turned to Alan and said, you told me you got this special diploma, you told me you got a special letter from Mr. Hale, the headmaster. Will you slip upstairs and get them and bring them down for me? Alan darted away and could be heard running up the wooden stairs. Dr. Thompson turned to the father and said, Bond, you've got a bright boy there, he might even be a genius. I've been talking to his headmaster. Martin Bond turned on him in a fury. And what's it got to do with you? How do you come into it? You leading the boy into trouble, or something? He asked. For a moment the doctor's face clouded with wrath, and then controlling himself with an effort he said, every so often, Bond, somebody comes to this earth perhaps with some carryover from a previous life. I don't know what it is, but people have strong impulses, very strong impressions. Well, they don't get it for nothing. Your son seems to be one of those. His headmaster was very emphatic that the boy was bright and that he was born to be a doctor. If you think I'm leading him astray, well, you think again. I'm trying to help him. Alan dashed into the shop again, just about breathless with the speed of running. Meekly he held out to the doctor the diploma and the copy of the letter from the headmaster, together with the acceptance of the headmaster's recommendation from the dean of the pre-med school of Street Maggots. Without a word the doctor took the papers and read them from start to finish. There wasn't a sound except the rustling of papers as he turned over a page and put the read page on the bottom. Then, finished, he said, well, this convinces me. I think you ought to have your chance, Alan. We'll see what we can do. He stood for a few moments wondering what was the best course to take, and then he turned to the father and said, why can't you? Your wife and I have a talk about this. The boy is brilliant. The boy definitely has a mission. Can I talk to you somewhere? Martin turned sourly to Alan and said, well, you started all this, you brought all the trouble here. Get on with that weighing up and I'll have the doctor talk to your mother and me. So saying he led the way out of the shop and up the stairs, being very careful to close the stair door after him and calling up, Mother. I'm bringing Dr. Thompson up, he wants to talk to us about Alan. Upstairs Mary Bond hastened to the top of the staircase muttering to herself. Oh, heavens, oh my God, what has that boy done now? Chapter 7. Mary Bond felt all fluttery inside as if a whole load of butterflies had got into her somehow. She looked with apprehension from the doctor to her husband and then to Alan, who had crept up the stairs behind them. Helplessly she showed the doctor into their sitting room where only favored visitors ever went. Father Bond said, okay, Alan, off to your room. The doctor instantly interrupted saying, oh, but Mr. Bond, Alan is the most interested person in this arrangement. I definitely think that he should be here in this discussion. After all, he's not a child now. He is approaching an age when many others would be at college, and we hope that he's going too. Reluctantly Martin Bond nodded his head in acquiescence and the four of them sat down, the mother with her hands folded demurely in her lap. Dr. Thompson seems to think our boy has got a lot of goods up in his attic, said Martin Bond. He wants to talk to us about him because he thinks Alan should become a doctor. I don't know what to say about it. The mother sat still and said nothing, and then Dr. Thompson spoke. You know, Mrs. Bond, he said, there are some very strange things in life, and people get impressions that they have to do a thing without knowing why. Alan here, for instance, he gestured in the boy's direction, has a very, very strong impression that he has to enter medicine. The impression is so strong that it is almost an obsession, and when we get a boy, or a girl either, for that matter, who insists on a special career almost from the first words they can utter, then we have to be convinced that the good Lord maybe is getting a message through, or is trying to work a miracle or something. I don't profess to understand it. All I know is this. He looked around at them to see if they were following him, and then continued, I was an orphan. I was brought up in an orphanage and, to put it in its mildest form, I had a very hard life in the orphanage because the people there thought that I was different in some ways because I, too, had a definite vocation, and that was that I should enter medicine. Well, I did enter medicine and now I'm doing quite well at it." The parents sat still, their brains almost obviously clunking over as they tossed thoughts around inside their skulls. At last Martin Bond said, "Yes, doctor, yes, I agree with everything you say. The boy should have his chance in life. I had none neither and I'm having to fight to pay bills. But, tell me doctor," he looked really hard at Dr. Thompson and continued, "we are poor people. We have a hard job to pay our bills every month, and if we don't pay our bills every month then we don't get our supplies, and if we don't get our supplies then, by golly, we're out of business. So tell us, how are we going to provide for Alan? We can't afford it and that's all there is to it." Martin Bond slapped his knee vigorously to emphasize that here was Finis, the end, and all the rest of it. Alan sat the downcast, looking glummer and glummer. "If I was in the USA," he thought, "I'd be able to take a part-time job and study the other part-time and I'd get through that way, but this country, well, there doesn't seem much hope for poor lads like me." Dr. Reginald Thompson was thinking. He put his hands in his trouser pockets and stretched out his legs, and then he said, "Well, as I told you, I've had a hard life and I've done what I believe I had to do. Now, it may be that I've got to help Alan, and so I'll make this offer to you." He looked around to see if they were paying attention, and indeed they were. Alan was looking straight at him, Father Bond was looking lesser, and Mother Bond had stopped fiddling with her fingers. Satisfied with what he saw, the doctor continued, "I am a bachelor, never had any time for the women, you know, been too interested in study, research, and all the rest of it, so I stayed a bachelor and I saved a lot of money. By doing so, I am prepared to invest some of that money in Alan if he can convince me that he really will make a good doctor." Mary Bond said, "That would be a wonderful thing, doctor. We tried to take out an insurance policy which would help Alan pay expenses, but there was no such policy suitable to people of our means, or rather, lack of means." The doctor nodded silently, and said, "Well, he's all right in the educational line because the headmaster of his school spoke very highly indeed about him, and he has a free scholarship to enter St. Margaret's Pre-Med School, just the same as I had, but that doesn't pay his living expenses, and it would be better for him to live in college, and it doesn't pay for various other expenses. So this is what I'll do." He sat there sucking in his cheeks and blowing them out. Then he turned to Alan and said, "This is what I'll do, Alan. I'll take you to the Huntrian Museum up at the Royal College of Surgeons and we'll spend a day going through the museum, and if you can stick it out without fainting or anything then we can be sure that you will make a success as a doctor." He was silent for a few moments and then continued, "I can take a step more than that. I can take you to a dissecting room where they have bodies and bits of bodies all over the place. If you go and be sick all over them then you're out of the doctor line. If you can convince me, okay. We'll have a partnership, you've got your scholarship, I'll pay all the expenses, and when you are a qualified doctor able to pay back then you do the same for some other unlucky soul who is trapped between what he knows he has to do and his inability to do it through lack of money." Alan nearly fainted with relief and happiness, but then Father Bond said slowly, "Well now, doctor, we rely on the boy to do our deliveries for us, you know. We've kept him all this time. It's only right he should do something for us, and if, as you say, he's going to be stuck away somewhere in some college living in luxury then what about his poor parents? Do you think I'm going out after hours and deliver?" Mrs. Bond looked shocked and said, "But Martin, Martin, surely you remember that we managed before Alan came on the scene?"
"Yes, of course I know," said Martin angrily, "I'm not likely to forget. But I'm also remembering all the boy's been to us all these years. We've had to provide for him, and now when he's had all he can get from us he's going to rush off and be a doctor if you please, and I suppose that's the last we shall ever see of him, bar." Martin Bond's hands were working together as if he was longing to strangle somebody, and then he burst out, "And what do you get out of it, Dr. Reginald Thompson? Why have you suddenly taken such an interest in the boy? That's what I want to know. People just don't do things for others, you know, unless they've got some motive behind it. What are you getting out of it? Dr. Thompson laughed out loud and then said, My goodness me, Mr. Bond, you've convinced me that your son is quite exceptional. All you think about is what you can get out of things, and all he thinks about is how he can help others by being a doctor. You want to know what I'm getting out of it, Mr. Bond? Well, I'll tell you, I have impressions just the same as your son has impressions. I have the strongest impression that I've got to help him. Don't ask me why, I don't know why, and if you think that I am after him sex-wise, well, then, Mr. Bond, you are a bigger fool than I thought you were. I can get plenty of boys, and girls too, if I want them. But this time I want to help Alan for the sake of something that I know, something at the back of my mind and won't come forward. But if you don't want to have him helped, Mr. Bond, then we will wait until he is 21 and, although it will be a bit late, well, we'll take it from there. Now, I'm not here to argue with you. If you don't want to go on with this, say so and I'll get out. Drive Thompson got to his feet looking a very truculent individual indeed. His face was red and he looked as if he would like to throw Martin Bond through his own front window. Martin Bond twisted his hands about and fiddled with the end of his jacket, and then he said, Well, maybe I was a bit hasty in what I said, but I'm wondering how we can manage to get the spuds taken out at night and things like that. We've got to live, you know, as well as the boy. Bond broke in very hurriedly, Shush, Martin, shush, we can arrange that all right. We can soon get a schoolboy come along and do it for us. It won't cost much, it won't cost as much as keeping Alan here. Martin Bond slowly nodded his head. All right, he said with some reluctance and go. You're not 21 yet and I still have control of you, and you make a success of that doctoring job you're going to do or you'll hear from me about it. With that the father turned abruptly and clattered down the stairs to the shop. Mary Bond turned apologetically to Drive Thompson and said, I am so sorry about this, doctor. My husband sometimes is a bit impetuous. He is Aries, you know, so it was arranged. Dr. Thompson would take Alan to the Huntrian Museum on his day off next week. With that arranged, the doctor went home and Alan returned to his room to study. Hello there, Alan, said Dr. Thompson as Alan presented himself at the surgery a week later. Come on in, we'll have a cup of tea and then we'll get in the car and we'll go off to Lincoln's Inn Fields. They had their tea and some biscuits, and then the doctor said, You'd better go in there, boy. All the excitement might stir you up and I don't want you taking a leak in my nice clean car. Alan blushed and her ride off to the littlest room where, we are told, even a king must go on foot. Dr. Thompson led the way out around a path going along the back of the house. There he had his car parked, a good old Morris Oxford. Unlocking the doors he said, Get in, and Alan thankfully got in the passenger seat. Alan was not very used to private cars. All his travelling had been done on clattering trams or rattling buses. He watched with avidity as the doctor started the engine, waited a few moments for it to warm up and then checked the charge rate and oil pressure, and drove out. Do you know the best way to go, Alan? Asked the doctor quizzically. Well, sir, replied Alan, I've looked it up on a map and all. I can say as you go along the East India Dock Road and then go over London Bridge, and I suppose, he said rather tremulously, we have to go over Waterloo Bridge as well. Said the doctor, I've got you this time, we're not going across any bridges, you follow the route carefully because if my plans come right you'll be doing this journey quite a few times. Alan was quite enthralled looking at all the places outside his own locale of Tower Hamlets. He had not been able to move about much, and yet he had a most uneasy feeling that many of these districts through which they were driving had been well known to him at some time. At last they turned right and went up Kingsway in Holborn, up Kingsway for quite a distance, and then they turned into Sardinia Street which led to Lincoln's Inn Fields. Dr. Thompson suddenly drove through some iron gates to the right and parked his car smartly. Switching off the engine and taking out the key he said, Here we are, lad, out you get. Together they walked into the entrance of the Royal College of Surgeons building and Dr. Thompson nodded with easy familiarity to one of the uniformed people standing inside. Okay, Bob? He asked one of them, and then nodding cheerfully he went on into a dark entrance lobby. "Come on, we turn left here." "Oh, wait a minute, I forgot, I've got to show you this." He stopped and grabbed Alan's arm saying, "Now, here's something which will make your teeth ache. Here are some early dental instruments."